Yes. Okay, we'll do that. This is the 8th of September, 2020, and this is a recording for a group of activists, mostly in the USA, that is operating presently under the title of the Supreme Court of the Law for the USA, and that is because we don't have a Supreme Court of Law in the USA. We got a de facto municipal court of limited jurisdiction. And so we're trying to empower our common people by providing them with an American National Supreme Court of Law. And we hope to discuss things like that with our Canadian friends because they're prompting what they're referring to as a constitutional convention, which has similar broad-based implications for the entire court system and model of government that is happening there in Canada. I think one of our more prominent spokespeople from the Canadian, my agenda. I do like to follow the agenda that I've written up, and I would like to take a brief moment here to open with a prayer to the spirit realm to try to bless our efforts here at securing righteous truth, justice, and peace for the common people in North America and the whole earth. And so if I might just briefly do that, please indulge me, everyone. Champion of truth and justice in the universe. In the Bible, this is referred to as Yahweh Jehovah, who sent his precious son, Jesus Yeshua. And in particular, in light of these legends, we do like to humble ourselves before the more powerful spirit forces, especially of the Israelite and Christian tradition, which is linked to our Anglo-American common law due process. And here under, we humbly pray for blessings from the righteous side of the spirit realm to help us advance the cause of truth and justice and liberty in our nations here. And in the name of Jesus, we humbly pray these things. Amen. Thank you all. All right, looks like we're about the same in numbers here. I would like to, I think our agenda tends to indicate that the first issue on the agenda, well, that was prayer. And there under, come on up screen. Item two is, come on, sorry. Item two is, asking anybody if they've got any new items or issues that they would like to put on the agenda. Yes, a procedural issue, another procedural issue that is very good. Would anyone like to have me write down for the agenda what either a case or a an issue that you would like placed on upcoming conferences that we will be hosting here? Anyone, and we'll revisit this process before we close down, but anyone, do you have any additional items that you would like to present to the agenda? I do. Well, hearing none, okay, we'll revisit that issue later in the conference before we close down. And at that point, item number three on our agenda is to revisit our issues with our Canadian friends about the progress on the Constitutional Convention, and especially our three here that are from Canada. Would you like to give a brief opinion of if we made any progress in our last conference and how you feel progress is being made with your group there? I think you probably had other conferences during the week besides this one that are trying to work with the Canadian group. Would any of you like to summarize issues or concerns that the rest of us might be able to be some degree of help with. I yield.
It looks like Julie Anybody? Has something she wants to say there. Or Janet, sorry.
Julia?
Janet.
All right.
I think the biggest thing that we became aware of is there's a difference between natural law and common law. We just barely knew there was a difference between corporate law and common law. So now we're catching up with that. And that caused quite a stir in our pot. But we're all ears. We're trying to learn.
That sounds real interesting to me. Go ahead, Shane.
I just wanted to elaborate on what she just said, actually, because I think one of the things I said in our last meeting was that part of the beautiful part of this movement for us is that each of our provinces are doing this on an individual basis, and our provinces for the Americans obviously are just like your state. Well, not just like, they can be considered your states for metaphorical purposes. So,
sure.
I'm from Newfoundland, but I'm here representing the Alberta team, which would be a western province. And they are, both these ladies are from New Brunswick, I believe, which would be an eastern province. So, in Alberta, we've been looking at natural sovereign law as our basis. And it has caused a bit of a stir with some people who were unaware of it, and some people weren't even really aware of what common law was. And I've been trying to quell this in my own group in Alberta, in my own group in Newfoundland, because I do run a unified group there as well. It's just quite small. And I think I said it in our last meeting here, Charles, that what you call it means nothing at the end of the day, because we're starting from scratch. Now you guys, depending on what route you go, you might have a different approach, but for us here, we're starting brand new republics. We're not redoing a republic. We were never a republic. We were a half dominion, a pretend colony, and we've been de facto ruled ever since. So we can call it, and I make this joke, and I don't know how it'll go over here, but in Canada it gets a decent reception. You can call it Sharia law if you want. The name means nothing. It's the body of what you're building and how it is going to be applied. That's what matters. I see the joke there, yeah. So that's a bit of an ingest joke, right? But that's the point I'm trying to make is that what we call it doesn't matter. How you structure it and how it's going to work for the people, by the people, instead of against them, that's what matters. So we've looked at natural sovereign law as our basis. And from my research, everything that we're implementing is the root of what common law was when it started. So the fact that we're having this little in-group fight in our own little conference about this has been silly to me, because we're all aiming to give the people the power in their system of law. I even hesitate to say in their justice system. I don't even like using that word. In their system of law that's going to govern behavior of the sovereign. That's what we're setting up, and we're looking at natural sovereign law. From our research, it is very similar to what common law was at the root when it started, where it came from. So the New Brunswick team, they may like common law better. They may choose to go down that route. That's great. The people of New Brunswick have the power to make that choice. And if they choose to go the natural side, or they might like to rewrite, and they might make a combination of what they see in the Alberta team plus what they hear from you guys, and they might make a conglomeration of those two. That's the beauty of our movement has always been, that it's the sovereigns that have the power to make that choice. So that's just a bit of an elaboration on what she had to say there about the common law versus natural law.
Thank you, Shane. Does anyone else have any comments or questions? I would like to jump in on that to build on it a bit. The substance of the process and the manner in which the people are empowered at the grassroots is the prioritized issue, and I think Shane's point, in last conference we had Tuesday evening, I think we came to an agreement that as long as it's empowering the grassroots of our common people in responsible manners, it doesn't really matter what we call it. But I would like to add to that that there are different traditions, and some of the different labels. I like the way computers, you can rename a file. You can totally change the name of a file anytime you want it and put a new label on it. And I like to think of jars, mason jars in the pantry or something. You can put any label you want on that mason jar, but it's to reflect what the basic contents are in that jar. And you might move around as you become more enlightened about what the true history of the different terms and labels are. But you know basically what's in the jar, whether you're making grassroots empowerment at the township and the qualified electors level, or if you're doing something different, you know what's in the jar and what the package is. And so they're under, I think we're in a complete agreement, but I do think it is important to have labels that have some degree of real world meaning that accurately reflects what's in the jar or what the computer program actually is supposed to accomplish. And they're under, unless there's, we're going in some other direction, I would like to explore the words said by Julia, I believe, earlier, that there's problems with common law, or there's difficulties with common law, and I guess a side issue there too is apparently there's differing factions in your group that's having a little bit of a debate on these issues. Can you guys shed more light on how the differing factions are arguing, and more specifically also what the nature of the problem is with common law itself? Apparently some people think that that's got some problems, which is a little bit different than my views, but I would like to explore it. Maybe I'm wrong on something. I yield.
Yeah, Charles, from our perspective in Alberta, what we did with our research, part of our hesitancy came from, and this has to do with our history and why we're trying to do what we do. We're trying to break away from the crown. So we've found through our research there's a heavy link between common law as it's practiced and the crown and the bar system as well. So when we discovered natural sovereign law, and I take this term sovereign out, we apply that because we're applying it to our new republic, natural law. We looked at a system of natural law that the natives were using in our country. And these were more guiding principles. I think it was brought up in one of the other meetings. I don't think it was explained very well to the group, from what I heard. But it's seven guiding principles. They're not laws. They're not anything like this. They're seven guiding principles, and they amount to do no harm, essentially, which sounds a lot like common law, right? So from what we could find, it seems as though any form of common law that we've come across, because there are different sections or factions of common law with different roots even, but they seem to all derive from a form of natural law that was used before, and it wasn't really a written legal system in any sense. It was guiding principles that guided the behavior of the people. So what we've been doing is applying those principles to a, I guess you could call it a common law, because that's what common law is. It's when the laws become common enough that they're kind of written for the people. So this is the crossover that I'm talking about, and why I find it so funny that there's this disagreement between them, because I see them as cousins in a family type thing. So, you know, and with that, I'll just yield, because I think Janet had her hand up as well. She wanted to say something.
Sure, Janet. Yeah, all right. Janet.
Yeah. Hi, yes. I would say we're pretty open-minded in New Brunswick, but we do lack some expertise, especially when it comes to law. So for us, it's a big learning curve. And a lot of the reading we had done in Canada and in the UK it seemed like common law was the way to go. So it's our misunderstanding, I think, that it was kind of the intended path for us to follow. But I realize there is no pure law system in the world today. Nobody's pure anything. Everything is going to be a hybrid. So I really appreciated that what Shane said last week is we all are free as sovereigns to choose what we want to do. But it is nice to know we could save ourselves 20 years of grief going down common law when maybe it's not really what we want. But it's sort of like a smorgasbord. We have to figure out what's in front of us and then choose. But we didn't really know. So it's just been a learning curve, and we haven't had any disagreements, but we have certainly had to ask some hard questions. And we are also supporting Nova Scotia, and they have a personality involvement, somebody that's leading them into common law, and they want us to kind of, because the Maritimes, our population is a bit smaller than out west. They have like millions of people. We don't have even a million people. PEI's got like 125,000. So we're looking at really small populations here. And a lot of times, a lot of things they want to do is like in coalition. And we're trying to say, no, I think we should be independent and develop ourselves independently. And I think that it is right that each province has to decide which way to go. But it's mostly, we just needed to know the option. And I'm really glad, actually, that it came up. It just made us feel very confused because we thought for sure we knew where we were going. So it's just a learning curve. It's a learning curve, and I think we're still working on it.
Yes.
But anything we choose will be a hybrid. We realize that now.
Oh, I'm not so sure. I think there might be something better. But others, Abraham, did you have comments?
I'm just getting familiar with the tone of the group.
No comments yet, then?
Not yet. I'm in the assimilation mode.
Very good. Very good. Anybody else? Shane?
I might
I just have one quick thing that I just wanted to say. There's a bit of an impression that we've turned common law into the boogeyman here up in Canada, and I really don't want that impression to come across. We have some personalities in Canada, individuals, that speak out against common law for whatever the reasons are. But that has no reflection of us as a group to unify the people or any individual provinces for that matter. What we've done is we've found a lot of things we liked about common law. We found some hesitancies based on where we saw the majority of it coming from through the Crown and through the bar system. And then we saw that we had a native people here living by what seemed to be a pure form of what we saw common law as, so we tried to bring the two together and adopt them as a conglomerate. But we're not in any way trying to insinuate that common law would be a bad way to go. There are people who are going to have those opinions and will express them, and we can't prevent that, and nor would I want to, because I like the discussion. But I don't want anyone to think that as a group we are actively telling you not to seek out common law or anything of that nature. That's not our message, certainly not as a group. If individuals express it, like I said, that's their right to express it, but that's not, and from our perspective, we're adopting much of what we've found through common law. So there's no, it's not a malicious intent, or it's not a turning common law into the boogeyman, nothing like that. And we do encourage every province, if that's the route they go, absolutely, 100%. Whatever the sovereigns of their province want, that's what should happen.
Thank you, Shane. David, did you have something to say?
Well, yes. When I think of common law, I think in terms of smallness. And you know, Skousen, in his book, The 5,000-Year Leap, basically brought government down to the home, and the government that goes on with the at the individual level and at the family level, and then it extends from there to the smaller community and to the then the larger community. And so it's the it all boils down to the centers of power being within ourselves and within the smaller groups. And so to me, regardless of what we want to call it, that common law is truly at the grassroots. I yield. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Comments, questions, anybody? If there's not, I'd like to expand a little bit on my views of the value of common law properly interpreted. Now, to the credit of a lot of people that have reservations, ever since 1066 AD in England, common law has been perverted. It turned into a mechanism to placate the masses and to retain control by the top-down authoritarian Roman Empire model of government, municipal model of government. So it's been perverted, and that's been with us for a very long time. So I'm not surprised that a lot of people have bad opinions of common law, because it's been adulterated and turned into a tool of tyranny and oppression. But if you look at the roots of the common law, and especially its most prominent feature, is the trial by jury process, which preserves the right of the people to form their own communities of specific number of people, 12, to render unanimous verdicts about the guilt or innocence of people within their venue jurisdiction that are alleged to have committed crimes. And this process decentralizes the power down to the local communities. And when you try to get 12 people unanimously to agree on something from a local community, that creates a program, like a computer program, where you're not going to get consensus amongst that community unless, like the jury is required to have unanimous verdict. You're not going to get that unanimous verdict unless the consensus is formed around truly righteous, godly, fair judgments. And so it produces the workload of building the community consensus, the conscience of the community down at the local levels, and that creates a presumption that laws of nature, nature's God, natural sovereignty has been harmonized with by that local community, and they're under, everybody should just defer to that local judgment. Unless they've got something that they can point to that shows that first jury that tried it in their own local community incorrectly applied the traditional rules of due process of law, where you got to have a victim, you got to have a complaining party, you got to prove that the person was malicious, basically, mens rea. There's elements that are protections for individuals that are accused of crimes, as well as for making sure that the community is able to purge people that are criminals from their own community. So when people understand how the original process worked before it got adulterated, and it decentralized that power of the entire judiciary down to the grassroots level, there, without real serious cause shown, there was no appeal to higher courts. You had to have cause shown or something, and bringing in another jury was the only thing that could affect the first jury. It couldn't just be overturned by a majority rule Supreme Court like what we've got now in the States and I believe Canada. So it really decentralized the power there. I yield. Somebody like to say something? Got an echo or something there. Hello, new lady here. Hi.
Hi. It's Barb here in New Brunswick, Canada.
Barb in New Brunswick. All right, glad to have you with us, Barb. And I see Nancy is with us from Pennsylvania, or the States, and Stone. I don't know who that might be. Okay, well, our group is growing. This is a good thing. These conferences are still rather new, and I'm glad to see people joining with us as everything is unfolding here. I think I made a fairly decent point there. Would anybody like to comment and question on that, or maybe draw out Barb a little bit more, or anybody else?
I'll just introduce myself. I'm kind of with Shane from Alberta, and I'm Stone. So, hi, Charles.
Hi, Stone. Welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Charles, you said something very important that I'd like to draw on, because you the root of the common law that you were talking about before, the perversion, and how it's done trial by jury.
Yes.
And that takes away that centralized power or decentralized power somewhere else. It kind of decentralizes it and puts it with the people. That's what we've done with our natural sovereign law. And this is kind of why I see it. The more I learn about common law, the more I kind of see it as silly, any kind of a disagreement between the two, because I honest to God, I see natural law as we're applying it, as we're adopting it, as being the very root of this. Everything I learn about the original common law, that pre-Roman perversion, pre-European perversion, we'll say, that's what we're doing. So we're kind of just adopting a lot of this, what I call the true common law. And that perversion you alluded to, that's where our hesitancy comes from here in Canada, especially how closely tied we still are to the Queen, to the Crown. And you know, we can touch on that whenever, but the fact that we still have this very close tie to the Queen, even though we're told we don't, we all see it and we know it to be true, that anything that comes out of that British system, that monarchy, that bar system for legal, it sets red flags off. So we always try to say, okay, let's focus and figure out another way to do it. So that's where that hesitancy comes from. It's nothing at all to do with common law as a system or even the root of it, because as we did our research, we found that it was, in fact, very close to this pre-perverted common law from 1016, I think it was. So, yeah.
Yes.
And all
you. Thank you, Shane. Thank you, Shane. Comments, questions from anybody else? Okay. To perhaps clarify a little bit on the issue that we're discussing about the jury trial aspect of the common law tradition, I think I may have touched on it, but I'd like to expand a little bit further, that there's an opening phrase in America's Declaration of Independence that refers to the laws of nature and nature's God, and that's obviously natural law. There we go. That is that's a real good metaphor, but in a lot of discussions it lacks practical applicability. But when you contemplate the trial by jury process, when the local communities are forced to get unanimity of agreement between people, 12 adults of good reputation in the community, there's law books that reference that what they're doing there is they're trying to build ascertain in response to the complaint before the court, quote, the conscience of the community, unquote. And when you have a community coming together to agree on what is conscionable in the eyes of the community that knows both the accuser and the accused, then that creates a presumption that, at least for that community, natural law has been harmonized with. And either the accuser is told that he lacks merit in his case, or the accused is appropriately chastised, maybe punished somehow, for what he has done that to offend the conscience of the community, as adjudicated by the unanimous verdict of the reputable people in the community. And that is the goal. When the local town constable or the sheriff is assembling the jury, they need to be picking and choosing people so that both the accused and the accuser have people that are sympathetic to both of their views, but they've got good enough reputations in the community that we're inclined to believe that they're not just going to rubber stamp either the accuser or the accused. They're going to be looking for what's right before God and under the laws of nature that include keeping the peace and justice and truth for everybody. So when these are the ideals, these are the essential elements of common law due process, then we can see that it actually brings forth a mechanical mechanism for bringing theoretical, metaphysical justice and natural rights and sovereignty right down to the local communities. And frequently you'll hear people talking a lot of metaphysical mumbo jumbo about natural rights and sovereignty, but they've got no discussion of mechanical tools for bringing it down to the local community. Our common law tradition with trial by jury and the very small communities of the townships and the precincts of 10 households and 100 households, this creates a mechanism wherein all of that sovereignty is decentralized right down to the local communities, and then they assemble their own juries, and that creates harmony with natural law at the local level, and there's nothing else for the big, bad, nasty government of the Roman Empire at the national and provincial and state levels to do, because there's peace in the local communities. We got no problems down here. Our juries are functioning quite nicely, thank you. We'll call you if we need you. That's the model that I look to promote unfolding. So I hope that helps maybe make it a little bit more clear in people's mind. I'll yield for comments or questions there.
Charles, you made an interesting. I don't know. It wasn't a point. I guess you just said something that piqued my interest, because you said when the sheriff is assembling the jury.
Yeah.
So one distinction that I've already noticed with our system that we've chosen, and again, when I say we, I'm simply referring to the province of Alberta, is that we would be hiring jurors as the community. So each community that has their own jury, each community actually would have jurors hired and ready for one-year terms, and they would be used as needed for juries. So that would be one. That's one distinction, but all of the criteria that you said that a sheriff would be looking for in a jury, good standing member of the community, that kind of stuff, that was all in the hiring requirements. Because the thing is, the system they're setting up has a lot to do with hiring and firing instead of electing or appointing. So that's one distinction I just wanted to kind of bring up right now, just that I noticed as you were discussing.
Thank you for pointing that out. That would open up a whole other discussion on the two different models there. And we could launch into that, but maybe there's anybody else like the microphone to make any points or ask any questions and maybe take it in another direction? Anybody, questions, comments?
Abraham Nevada, that's a pretty interesting concept Shane reflected upon, having a professionally paid jury of your peers.
Charles, that's something I hadn't contemplated before. Is that a doable scenario?
I'm sure it's doable. You can make a barn door fly if you put enough horsepower on it. Should we go ahead and try to compare more closely what you're looking at there, Shane?
I may finish my comment.
Sure. Yeah.
There, Janet. I wanted to chime in real quick.
Yeah.
Do you want to chime in?
I think that I don't think we looked at hiring our jury, but I think we did look into we would hire our sheriff. And the reason I think is because in Canada we are we've been thugged to death with lifelong politicians and positions here. We don't want it anymore. We want to make sure that we don't have that anymore. It's like every person, it seems, in every position has reached unlimited corruption. And so we like the idea that the power of the sheriff, the administrators at the national, regional, and local level are in the power of the sovereigns, because there's been a major, major problem that there's been no restraint in Canada. Sure maybe you look at other countries, that's fine, but we are so fresh from the wound, we don't want it in New Brunswick ever again. And I would like to see that the jury are, again, because of our population size, we're not going to be able to have, we thought, a jury in every city or town. We wanted to know if our jury, we could have like a fixed jury that would actually travel throughout the province, just until we get started. And I think that might be the way that we will go, is we will have those people that will take an oath, and they will form that jury, and they will stay on for a year and cover every case until we get going, if possible. I yield.
Okay, I was looking at Shane's comment that, Charles, if you have a jury, like a qualified elector, or like, let's say, a justice of the peace or a town constable or a common law judge, that is immediately recallable because they've lost favor in the community and they are not acting in the capacity of the best interest of the people. And if that becomes apparent, like Janet said, they appear to have overtones of corruption, then that one-year tenure would be immediately recallable should anybody be able to catch any dirt on a juror. But the idea of a professional juror, I think I've heard that floated a couple of times in the past. That may not be such a bad idea. If you're on a jury and you're there for like 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 2 months, that could be a lot of waste of time if you're being out there for $5 a day or $10 a day and you got to give up a job where you're making, you know, $5,000 a month. You know, that public service as opposed to a $5,000 a month job that you got to give up, something wrong there.
Right. Anybody else? I can jump in on that, but comments, questions, others? Okay. Julia? Janet?
Yeah.
Did you want to say something? Yep. We can't hear you. Do you have your mute on? I think you're muted.
Yes. I think it's a good idea if the entire sovereigns are exposed to the idea of serving on as a juror at some point. I think it's a responsibility of everyone that could take part in being a juror. I think it would help the society to understand these positions and what goes on and the processes. And it's an education. So I think it's a good idea to rotate it quite regularly and get fresh blood.
Okay. Thank you. If your mute's on again, it sounds like, Julia. But maybe I can go ahead and give a little bit of an answer there. The older common law tradition prior to the Norman conquest in 1066 AD was the small communities all had people of good reputation in the communities. These were the electors, the qualified electors in the township community. And they all knew each other's reputation, and they just didn't allow people in that were habitual liars. Those people were, in essence, outlaws. So the entire community had reputation, and they knew each other. They knew each other's reputation for being honorable or dishonorable people in the local community. And this is why a big portion of why the jurors were not called until a complaint was brought before the court. If there's no complaints before the court and there's nothing but peace in the whole kingdom, then there's no need to have jurors being sitting around getting paid, waiting for a case to come, because they should be out enjoying the good weather and stuff and enjoying the peace and quiet and the happiness of God's life on this earth, instead of supposedly sitting as a paid juror or something, like the alternative model here seems to be proposing. And of course, you could loosen it up so it's not quite that bad. But the very idea of paying the jurors that inherently brings in discussions about what's the economic system going to be. Are we still going to have Federal Reserve notes here in the states dominating how we compensate our jurors to serve, and Bank of England or whatever it is in Canada that is in control of the money supply up there? Is that how you're going to be paying your jurors in the money of the realm? Or see, we're on the edge of needing not only a new form of government and judicial system, but also a new economic system. And at the local township level, in the pure common law tradition, the leader of the township, the 10 household community, was not only called the town constable, he was also called a tithing man. And the township community was called a tithing group. And this gets to the more religious aspects and metaphysical aspects of the community building that we're talking about here, because at that point, it's voluntary donations from the community, like tithings in a church. You donate what you have, and if you don't have anything, well, you contribute firewood or whatever you might have that you can contribute, your labor, your wise counsel. There's all kinds of things that people could contribute in terms of goods and services, to which can be accounted for in terms of economic accounting systems, and to thereunder produce a system of commerce that's not based upon central banking or treasury, but is decentralized down to the local township and tithing group of approximately 10 households. And when we do it that way, then the jurors don't have to be thinking in terms of giving a service in exchange for some Federal Reserve notes or Canadian currency, but they can be thinking in terms of getting paid in firewood or other goods and services, veggies, from their local township community members or in the larger precinct. And we've got a document worked up called Oath of Office for a Town Constable. It's a two-page document, and it's spelled for a qualified elector, pardon me, not a town constable. Then that's the grassroots level. And that grassroots level qualified elector oath that promises to serve as a responsible member of the local township community, they promise that when they are called by their town constable to serve as a juror, that unless they've got a real good excuse not to, they will be vigilant in assisting and administering justice as jurors. And there under, we've got a community of people that is basically on call at the grassroots level as a component member of their qualified elector status in their own local townships. And when we've got a broad community like that that's signed the oath of office as a qualified elector and they're on call, then it's real easy to just call them. They're already getting a basic standard of living from the community resources that's shared amongst the tithing group community and the higher levels. And so they've got their own social safety net there as long as they carry their duties. And one of those duties is to serve as a juror for the local community if and when it's needed. And they're under a much more grassroots, organic, friendly process than trying to have, it sounds like, professional jurors that are allocated for one-year terms. I think I've drawn out some important alternatives there. I should yield for comments or questions here. I yield. Shane, or anybody?
Yeah, I do. You raised a couple of good points there, actually. one of the things was the currency. Well, actually, no. We'll talk about the choosing of the electorate first, because that in Alberta, we looked very heavily at common law, and we looked at specifically what you're talking about, having what we would call them sheriffs here. I heard you say constable as well, but I think we agreed upon sheriffs. And sure. And having, you know, qualified electorate that could be called upon. That was one thing we did look at. The reason we chose, or we swayed against, we'll say, because we still haven't really, there's nothing set in stone. That's one thing we got to keep in mind here, right? We're always learning. So the reason we've swayed away from that is because in a more modern scenario, people don't stay in their localities like they used to. People move around a lot, and even outside of their townships, and trying to maintain those qualified electorates or enough of them within every township when people are constantly, you know, the way modern era is, you're always moving. People are taking jobs in different townships and that kind of thing. You're picking up your whole family. So the way we thought about it was, if they were hired for a year contract, then they would be there for the year. Like that would be their job. They would now. There may be. You alluded to a point where there's some sitting around, not really doing much, because you're not. I mean, you're not guaranteed to be sat in on cases, because that would depend on the behavior of the people. So I think we had discussed ways that they could be put to use within the system when they're not actively sitting in on cases. And there's one more thing I will touch on, because I can't elaborate on that part of it. Some of our documents that we're doing up, we can't really fully disclose. And I think you can appreciate the fact that we're operating within our... We don't have a constitution to back what we're doing. So... the talk of setting up a grand jury within Canada amounts essentially to treason. We publicize our constitution and stuff like that, because these are just documents we're writing. But when it comes to intent to set up courts outside of our own system that's already present and has authority, our government gets pretty upset with us when we do stuff like that. So we keep those plans kind of down low for now. But the real thing to think about, too, there was one more point about currency you said. Alberta's plan is to have a sovereign Republic of Alberta currency. They're dropping the Canadian dollar. So they wouldn't be paid through a Federal Reserve note. We have a Bank of Canada, very similar to the Bank of England. It is structured almost identically to the Bank of England. Alberta's dropping the Canadian dollar. They're having a sovereign currency that would be produced locally, and yeah. So I'll yield.
Thank you, Shane. Thank you, Shane. Comments, questions, anybody? Okay. Anybody? A lot of food for thought here. I'm glad y'all are sharing the details of what's going on there. And I guess the most prominent point in my mind on the table would be y'all did mention in the last conference about the tyranny and despotism there in Canada is probably more terrorizing than what we've got here in the States. Apparently they really railroad you guys nasty up there if you start talking about liberty and justice too much. And certainly discretion is the better part of valor. You got to choose your battles. And there will be points when the de factos are weak, and there's points when you're strong. And you don't want to just go in there and splat like a bug on a windshield. When if you time your activities and think about them a little bit more prudently, you can actually maybe cause some changes in the evil empire regime that are positive instead of just committing suicide and not accomplishing a darn thing with your life. And so I certainly comprehend the idea of being cautious and not just going out there and picking fights with the bad guys. But I get a lot of feedback similar to with people right here in the States. They're as terrorized as y'all are up there in Canada. There's a lot of fear all over the whole earth. I'm in a special, unique position in that I've studied both the nature of the evil empire conspiracy. I know they've got a lot of weak points. And I've also studied law. And I've interacted with a lot of judges and attorneys. And I know that in courtrooms especially, and even in county commissioners' meetings, things like that, when we start talking to people in positions of power about how real law works, due process of law, common law tradition, they start running and hiding. They won't engage on the merits. Okay? And it's a psychological and spiritual battle, and they're creatures of darkness and they're bullies. And so if it doesn't take much to start bringing in a little bit of light about the tradition for securing justice through common law juries in the local communities, things like that, and how their present Roman Empire model of government is hostile to the cause of justice. And lights start going on in their heads and everybody in the room that's listening to what you're saying there, and all of a sudden they don't have words anymore to rebut logically and reasonably what you said. And at that point, they're looking for ways to escape and to go crawling back into their holes, and everybody in the room can see it because they're breaking a sweat on their forehead. So I do think that there's a whole lot of opportunities here, but probably one of the most essential ingredients of a qualified elector, and especially the people in leadership positions like the town constable and the justice of the peace and the county sheriff, a.k.a. county judge, on up the hierarchy of the common law grassroots-built system of local responsibly self-governing communities, one of the most important critical elements is the people in those leadership positions have to have courage. They have to have courage to take a chance to stand up and speak out and provide leadership. And if they're the first one to get arrested, drug off to the gulag or something, well, then that's the way it breaks. But We've got people in positions of leadership, and they're willing to take the chance. They're willing to roll the dice and bet that they can cause enough embarrassment on those de factos that they're going to back off rather than trying to grab me and take me off to a prison camp somewhere. So it's calculated risks, but I would suggest, and I'm constantly looking at these issues here in the States, and I would suggest you all try to do inventory. You guys know that there's different people in your own community there in Canada. Some are more courageous and some are less courageous, and it would be generally the more courageous ones that you might want to think about trying to put in positions of leadership, because those are the ones that will have the courage to speak out. And another footnote on all that is frequently you will have people in your community that are acting real courageous about some kind of superficial issue. But as soon as you start talking about some issue that is causing real serious changes or something like that, then all of a sudden they're timid and they don't want to do anything like that. And so it's a false sense of courage and leadership that some of these people are generating. And you don't know that until you get down to the real hard issues. And then you see, well, the kind of quieter guy back there in the corner, that's really the most courageous person we got in the room, because the person that's normally acting as the big tough guy, he's wimping out on the important issues. So it's really a vibes checking process. This gets down to documenting who are the qualified electors within your community. And at that point, you become an organic body politic, a community bound together that's watching out for the welfare of each other. It's a trust community. You know, there's large bodies of trust, written on the subject of trust. There's complete volumes of Corpus Juris Secundum and American jurisprudence that have 5 or 6 volumes all on just trust and fiduciary responsibilities and things like this. And this is the kind of bonding that is designed to come together in the grassroots township communities that were firmly in place prior to the Norman conquest and have still been given a lot of lip service right on up to the modern day. Town constables are still in office here in Texas. This is still part of our common law tradition. It's just that most of these offices are vacant and nobody's willing to step into them and start showing a little bit of courage and seeing how much we can take back from the de factos. So, I laid out a few things there. I'll take a break here and ask if Shane or anybody else would like to respond to my comments. I yield.
There's one really important distinction that you did say there. You have a lot of lip service being paid to these things. Like you said, you had a town constable in Texas is still a position or an office?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so you've got that constitutional backing, right? So this common law that you're trying to go forth with, it's pure and it's constitutionally backed, so there's no issue for you moving forward. Even any of our concerns that we would have had are out the door. We don't have that constitutional backing. I alluded to that in our previous chat, right? So we barely have an act of parliament that we're governed by. So that's why our rights, they pop up here, they disappear there. Whenever it's convenient for someone, it's here. When it's not convenient for the government, they're gone, because it's an act of parliament, and it's barely, barely an act of parliament. So that's why that's a main distinction for us. So where we're starting right from scratch with building a brand new republic and writing that constitution, I mean, in a way, we are the founding fathers of the Republic of, say, Alberta. So,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like to draw a bit of a funny metaphor, but you get the point, right? So
we're starting
from scratch, so we're going to try to make sure that we're starting with something as organic as we can make it, so that,
because
we're thinking years ahead, right? The founding fathers, when they wrote their constitution, were they thinking about the year 2020 and how a fake pandemic from a global elite body would disrupt people's civil liberties? I doubt it. So we're trying to have a bit of we're trying to have a bit of foresight when we're writing this as well. A topic came up with the right to bear arms in one of our constitutions, and I thought this was kind of funny because I brought up, what about ammunition? Shouldn't ammunition be verbally included in the right to bear arms? Because I can argue that the right to bear arms is a gun, and a gun does not come with ammunition. They're separate entities. So if I say you can't limit my right to bear arms, sure, I can buy whatever gun I want. But someone can come along and say, well, you can only buy one box of ammo per year.
Huh.
You know what I mean? So
well,
that's an important thing that I felt should have been protected. It should be the right to bear arms and to keep ammunition shall not be infringed upon in any way.
Like that, right? Yeah, that sounds good.
Because when I think of the way the Second Amendment is being corroded in the United States right now, a lot of it comes from magazine sizes, clip sizes. Because they're targeting the ammunition part of it, not the actual right to have the gun. Now, there are other states going different ways, but that's just one thing that popped into my head. A lot of people are attacking that right to bear arms, not through the actual arms, but through the ammunition side and the amount of ammo or the size of your clip or something like that. So that was just an interesting point as well I thought I'd bring up.
Thank you, Shane. Anybody else? I would like to return to the issue of... Julia, did you have a comment? Or Janet? Julia. Did you have a comment?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I don't know if this is on track or if it's relevant at all, but I mean, the concern for us is the longer this goes on, where is the tipping point? We're trying to be peaceful and lawful, but how much restraint can be expected when everything in our environment is criminal? Everything is criminal. Nothing is working. The laws don't work. The government doesn't work. The politicians don't work. The banking doesn't work. The education, the health care. At what point is it no longer like we're being the peacemakers? We're being peaceful, peaceful, peaceful. But as people are being dragged off, we're sitting in a park. At what point? We have nothing. There's no law in our country, so why are we trying to be lawful? I'm just amazed. Like, I'm a very peaceful person. I would never think about having a gun, but you know what? We do have guns in this country, and I'm just amazed at the restraint that we do have, because I don't think you would see this restraint in a lot of other countries right now. There's countries that are building gallows right now. So we are talking about trying to build a constitution, which is a very peaceful and lawful move. However, what makes us think that these people are going to listen to us at the end of the day? Even we can do all of this. We've done petitions. We've done protests. We've talked. We've written letters. At the end of the day, when we've done all we can do, what makes us think these people are going to listen to us? When I start to see, we see people in Australia just being dragged out of their homes. Oh, they're peaceful. Oh, they're very peaceful. I don't want to be panicking here, but truly, at what point do we have to say, you know what? These people are criminals, and we're living in the Wild West here. We're living in the Wild West. We have nothing. Like, isn't that right, Shane? Truly, what can we hang our hat on? Oh, we're peaceful. Well, that's not going to really help if we don't get to the point, are they going to listen to us? And how long is this going to go on? Another 2 months, 3 months? Unless we know there's some kind of cavalry coming. Like, seriously, I don't know how much more people expect us to be restrained. We've got people here, they're making the children wear masks 6 hours a day. 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds. They're lying. These people are lawless. You can't even go to a store. Oh, you get kicked out of a store for not wearing a mask. These people are lying. Everything is lying to us. At what point do we give them a good hit up the side of the head? That's all I have to say. I yield.
If I may.
Thank you, Jay. David.
Well, I was telling Charles yesterday, I think, on the phone, is that I saw an interesting documentary on Netflix about Peru and how Peru was being divided between the urban legislature and presidency versus the Amazon natives. And how the presidency was opening up the country for corporations, international corporations, to come in and basically exploit the resources of the Amazon, where the natives lived, to benefit all the people of Peru. Well, that has some repercussions to the people who have always lived in the local area of the Amazon and whose children were dying because of oil that was being drawn from the region and oil pipelines and things like this that were polluting the waterways and everything else in the area. It was totally affecting their lives and killing children. And so they did have to draw the line. And when they did, they organized themselves. They started. They first petitioned to the people in the other areas of the country, of the urban areas of the legislature, and asked them to repeal the law, the unconstitutional law that allowed them for these companies to come in and rape the people of the that region. And when the legislature stalled them and did nothing about it, they ended up starting to block the roads, and the police of the urban areas, they sent the police to intervene. Of course, the police are just doing their jobs as were the Nazis in Germany, but the government was just sitting in the background doing absolutely nothing except doing their stalling and benefiting by their corruption. Well, the bottom line was that there was a truce initially between the police and the natives. They all realized that they're looking at their brothers, from across the fence, and they had a truce going on. But the legislature continued to do nothing, and so they sent more police into the area. And it was only after people started getting killed on both sides that there was any beginning of a resolution. And that the documentary pretty much ended by saying that even though the legislature repealed the problematic law, that in the back doors they were still making the deals and still allowing these companies to come in even though there was no formal legislation for it. So they are criminals. The corruption is going to go on anyway. And the bottom line is that the people have to come together en masse and do something about it. I yield.
Thank you, David. Comments, questions, anybody?
Yeah, Charles, two quick points, I think, to what Janet asked and what David responded in a way. The United States was a British colony, we'll say, and there was some internal revolution, and they had a constitution that was ratified and then began to be recognized. The other point I will say, and Janet should be privy to this, I don't know if her American friends would be or not, but the Crown has granted us our authority to do this. And it specified not only Canada, but each of her provinces. So you'd be surprised what a bit of international recognition would do if the proper steps are taken, which is why we're trying to, you know, I know you said we're playing nice and stuff. Just keep in mind, we're playing nice, but we have a plan B. That's all that needs to be said about that. But we're doing this through proper channels as properly as possible and as peacefully as possible so that when it's done, there's no excuse to not be recognized by our former overlords. And if that recognition comes through, then you have to assume that the United States follows. And there would also be some countries that we probably wouldn't want their recognition. I say we want, you know, think about, I'm just thinking out loud, but there would be countries that oppose Canada's foreign policies that might throw us a recognition because it screws Canada over. But still, it's more international recognition. So, and that's that starts the snowball effect. Well, if the Crown recognizes you, that's England. And if, you know, Donald Trump or God forbid, Joe Biden or Jill Jorgensen gets in, I don't know which is more likely, Joe Biden or Jill Jorgensen at this point, but then I think that's all the recognition you would need. Canada would be forced to recognize you anyways. Now, we also have to deal with provincial recognition first before we even look at the federal government. You've got to get your provincial government to recognize and to unseat. And once they do that, the federal government has no choice. They're out. So it's our provincial government we're aiming for in recognition. And we've been granted the right to do this lawfully by our former overlord. So that's what we're aiming for with our procedure, and that's why we're doing it the Mr. Nice Guy. But don't get it twisted, we do have plan B's in place for if it goes south.
Excellent. Good choice of words, Shane. Comments, questions, anybody else? And thank you, David, for the illustration about the Native Americans in South America there. That was seemed appropriate to me. In the discussions here, I love there's so many issues related to this. It's like a big picture puzzle that we're looking at, and we're trying to put pieces together to see what the picture really is and how it works out. Here under the some of the most important things, I think Shane mentioned about how we've got a constitution that protects a lot of our common law rights in the USA and the various states they're under. We've got 51 constitutions, actually, that have bills of rights. And it, like in the federal constitution, the Seventh Amendment, yeah, I know it's fuzzy, but at least the wording is there. It's a solid affirmation, and we can point to it and thereby embarrass the de factos into backing off a little bit and respecting some of our rights. Whereas apparently things are more fluid in Canada and England and Australia and the other British Empire colonies and sub jurisdictions. The issue that I'm trying to raise there is, I think, even though, admittedly, we do have more of our common law rights spelled out in our Constitution documents, those Constitution documents firmly implanted a Roman Empire model of government in the USA. The advantages that you guys have, see, USA declared independence from Britain, from the British Crown, I think is how the document's worded. And so that caused a divorce between us and the laws of England, the realm of the common law sovereignty that is inherent in the tradition of England. So I think that was a mistake on our end, and opened us up to the formation of Roman municipal civil constitutions being set in place with their statutory codes that have built the biggest military industrial complex on the earth, and very similar to the evil Roman Empire that was a slave trading jurisdiction. That we've got a lot of things in the USA that are quite a bit nastier than what you guys in the UK have got, at least in some areas. And I'd like to point out, revisited an issue that came up in our broader discussion with the other Canadian activists in our last conference, was revisiting the issue of Magna Carta. See, I do believe that tapping into the horsepower of Magna Carta is in many ways inhibited by our Roman Empire model municipal constitution documents, whereas you guys don't have that brick wall between you and the ancient common law tradition that was largely preserved in Magna Carta and is part of the lawful heritage of England and all of the smaller communities under the protection of England. You guys have that natural right as common law tradition unquestioned in the chain of events that's happened through your nations. And whereas us over here in the States, we've got to kind of make an additional argument and jump over a brick wall of Roman civil municipal constitutions in order to get to that horsepower. So even though in a lot of ways you guys don't have the gun rights that we've got and some of the specific common law provisions that we've got, in other areas, you guys are more closer to the true organic grassroots common law than we are. So I'd like you to kind of maybe contemplate on that, because those are things, you know, I think earlier Shane was apprehensive about asserting the town constables doing arrest warrants or anything like that. That probably would blow up in your face in the near future, but the plan B there in trying to put it together for, like, what Janet was saying, we got to prepare, because they're trying to lock down the whole New World Order evil empire, and we've got to have a trigger point, a line in the sand, where if they cross it, we're going to resort to our common law tradition, right? Magna Carta 31 or 63 talks about what to do if the king starts becoming a tyrant. The leadership of the individual communities manifesting in the barons there, the 25 barons, they've got the right to take the king out of the throne, burn down his house, tar and feather him, basically. I forget what all the penalties are. They're pretty ugly. The people in Magna Carta have the right to take everything back. The fella, I think it was Dallas Hill, that was asserting that Magna Carta is a terrible document, I see that as being probably at least equal in power to our USA Constitution documents. And if you guys were, instead of being apprehensive and looking at Magna Carta as a problem, if you start thinking about it as a tool that you can use to your advantage, then I think you might be more motivated to stand up and be a little more courage, draw a firm line in the sand, because the present government is violating Magna Carta. Okay? They're violating the rights of the people to have their own self-governing communities, as clearly described in Magna Carta. So you guys have just got a little bit different angles of argument to prosecute. I've got documents worked up for sending to people here in the States, especially people in positions of governmental authority, to notify them that they are acting in a tyrannical and despotic manner that is in violation of our fundamental constitutional system, and it amounts to treason. A second document talks about our right to establish our own self-governing communities as recognized in Magna Carta and common law tradition. And those two documents together affirm that we've got the right, if they cross the line in the sand that we draw, we've got the right to resort to arms and to arrest them with whatever force is necessary. And please deny this in a timely manner. I really advocate sending out documents like this to all of the de factos, and if they fail to respond and deny in a timely manner, then that kind of creates a presumption that you got the right to resort to armed resistance if they do try to lock down this New World Order military police state against you. So I think your position can be enhanced there if you just maybe try to tweak your arguments a little bit. I yield there. Shane, anybody would like to comment? Or
just very quickly before somebody else jumps in, because I saw David unmute. I just before I forget this, David, and then you can hop in. I alluded earlier to there are some strong personalities, some individuals that have their opinions that are quite strong about certain topics, and that doesn't necessarily represent the group as a whole. And I think you just gave me an example of what I was talking about directly. And one thing about the Magna Carta that I'd love if we were linked. If we were in England, we would definitely be able to be using this. We've lost our link to the crowd. We had that divorce you talked about. That happened first of all in 1901, and then again cemented in their own form of statutory law in England in 1931. So we've already divorced them. We just have left our Facebook status as still in a relationship. That's the only link we have to them right now. So if we were, in fact, linked in the way we were purported to, then I think we would have more standing under Magna Carta, and I think the citizens or people of the United Kingdom probably do have that standing. I'm not as wary as some seem to be about at least looking into it and utilizing aspects of it. And there are many people in our group that are open to it. So I wouldn't want you to get the impression that we are, you know, as a group, say, on the opposing. So, yeah. And David, sorry for butting in there, and I'll yield over to you now.
No problem. I wanted to add that imperialism has been an issue for all kinds of people all over the world, and I've been one of my degrees has been in the study of East Asian language and culture, being in Japanese, and I studied their history, and being also a former martial artist, still in spirit a martial artist, you know, the ninjas were a society that was set up to deal with some of those problems of the shogun and the various warlords that were of the area. And so, you know, there, at the common law level, we the people had the right, just like the colonists in dealing with Britain, to not always play fair. I yield.
Thank you, David. Comments, questions, anybody? Okay. Smaller groups, I love it. There's less intense competition for the microphone. Larger groups, the competition for the microphone gets kind of intense sometimes. I do like the more relaxed atmosphere where we can take turns and things like that. Shane, your comments on the crown and the divorcing of separation there. My research in law in just general American constitutional law, and which the better parts are derived from common law tradition, indicate the issues of vacant offices, and I dare say the crown, the throne, the monarchy of England, I think that can be viewed as an Anglo-American office, and I think the present queen is guilty of incompetence at minimum. And that they're under the throne of England can be presumed to be vacant. Okay. They're under the office is ruled by the organic traditional constitutional law of England, the laws of England, which is the common law. That's how the throne is to be ruled in its pure sense, without the adulterations from the Roman Empire version of government that has come in. That's what the true British monarchy is all about. And so when we realize not only is the present queen governing in an irresponsible and incompetent and derelict manner, but that problem has been with us for close to 1,000 years, as a matter of law, when we fixate on the point that the legal high ground, the moral high ground for claiming the throne as a vacant office, I think that strong arguments can be made that you in Canada and New Zealand and Australia and the other UK communities, and maybe even the USA, because, you know, I'm digressing. The USA has the common law tradition that allows us to claim that the common law monarchy, the rights. Well, where I wanted to go with that is the economic situation. The Bar Association of London, the British Accredited Registry, there's people that state plausible theories that all of the United States of America is controlled through the British Accredited Registry and the Bank of England, and that's how the economics and the legal system is controlled. So we're already under the control of England. Thank you. I think what we're looking at here is probably the potential for at least exploring the possibility of Canada and the USA and Australia and Zealand and all the other potential members of the United Kingdom can all merge together in a common effort at restoring fundamental principles of common law and targeting the British monarchy to institute a righteous, honorable common law monarch in the pure sense of the term in the throne, and purge out the corrupted queen that is presently in control. And if that would loosen up the Bar Association and the City of London banking system, their monopolies, that would probably break that up immediately at the same time too. And they're under the USA, and all the other common law tradition nations would experience vast amounts of freedom, all under a United Kingdom that was truly a kingdom of righteousness and common law tradition. I think that's rather a novel proposition, but I think that's doable. I'd like to yield for feedback on that kind of a proposition.
I'd like to take that thought one step further with the vacant office, Charles, because we have a Queen of Canada.
Okay.
And you might ask who's the Queen of Canada? Because in England, the Queen is indivisible. She can only be the Queen of one nation. So who the heck is the Queen of Canada? Well, that got brought up, I can't remember, I think it might have been in the 80s, but I might be wrong about that. And what they did, because of course there's no constitution, they're just acting on acts of parliament that just need simple majorities in parliament, they said, well, we can fix that. We can write a piece of legislation that says the Queen is divisible, and then we can pass it. So they did that, and now the Queen is divisible, and now she can be the Queen of but we have a Queen of Canada and a Queen of Canada technically an office. It exists only on paper. But there's no office for the Queen of Canada. There's no physical place for someone to be. It only exists through legislation. So is that a vacant office, or is that even an office that ever existed? Or did it exist before it was divisible, but now that she's divisible, is it vacant? It's a weird concept because the Queen of Canada is simply just whoever is the sitting monarch in England. So we had a King of Canada at one point and a Queen. Well, no, a Queen and then a King and a Queen or whatever. But yeah, so yeah. It's just, you know, is that a vacant office or does that office even exist if it's just on paper?
Well, I think the office that was created through the division there that you talk about, I think that is all legal fiction. I wouldn't want to put any resources, invest any time and energy in trying to make that fly. But
an off-the-cuff thought based on what you said, all.
Well, I do think, as a matter of organic law, that so long as Canada isn't merged with the USA or England or anything like that, that it would be a good procedural step to think of somebody in the position of a monarchy of Canada. And in fact, I would propose the same thing for the USA. In fact, presently, I would say Donald Trump is essentially acting as the monarch of the USA de facto. But it's more of an emperor, like in England. They're not complying with the rules of the common law as would be obligatory under a true common law monarchy. I would, if I was in your guys' position, I'd be thinking about replacing your prime minister or whoever your main officer is there with a common law monarch. And in times past in the USA, they've had de jure governors and de jure presidents. And in fact, there's a number of offshoot groups that talk about de jure presidents, you know, and still claim them. And they're a bunch of goofballs, in my opinion. But the idea, the proposition, is legitimate. If people were really to return to common law jurisdiction, we basically need what amounts to a military leader to fight the forces of the Roman Empire slave trading jurisdiction that has usurped all of our governmental authority and is reducing us to slave. And that is best personified in somebody that everybody can trust, which would be some form of a common law jurisdiction monarch, I would dare suggest.
You said something kind of interesting there with replacing our prime minister or whoever our head is here. And that was, it was a kind of off-the-cuff comment that you said, but it's so applicable, and I don't know if you realize how much you just hit the nail on the head. And most of my Canadian brothers and sisters don't know or understand this, and this is the root of our problem, is that we used to be governed by a governor general. That's who England sent over to us. And yes, we elected prime ministers, but the governor general stood above the prime minister. So the governor general was running our country. And those acts of history that I alluded to earlier in 1901 and 1931, was England saying, we're not doing that anymore. You're on your own, guys. So they don't send governor generals anymore. So what did Canada do? We started appointing our own governor generals.
Yeah.
So the prime minister we elect now appoints his own governor general, who then immediately stands above him. And that's enshrined in our Constitution Act, our Act of Parliament, under Executive Powers, Section 12. I'm not going to read this to you because you would start punching me through the screen. No, I wouldn't. Charles, it is the longest, it's one sentence. It's the longest English sentence in the history of the world. And it is the most convoluted sentence ever. But what it does is it enshrines the Governor General as the person who has all authority, sole authority. It's repeated throughout. Sole authority. And this is proven. Even in my lifetime, back in 2007, Janet can attest to this. We had an election. Stephen Harper won a minority government situation. But the other mm-hmm. parties in Parliament got together and said, no, 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 we want to form a coalition. We want this guy out. And they had the seats to do it, because that's what a minority means. He had barely enough to govern. But if all mm-hmm. the other parties got together, they actually have more than him. So they were going to form a coalition government. They have to go to the Governor General and get this approval, obviously.
Yeah.
So they go to the Governor, and the Governor General says, no. No, 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 no. You don't. Uh-huh. I don't want you to do that. And then they look back at Stephen Harper and say, go mm-hmm. run your minority government.
Mm-hmm.
So even in my lifetime, that was 2007, our Governor General has used Section 12 to exercise sole authority over the affairs of this nation.
Uh-huh.
So when you made the comment of replacing our Prime Minister or whoever is your boss, it sounded just like an off-the-cuff funny thing for you to say, but you took the nail and put it right into the board.
Thank you. Thank you. Sometimes we get lucky. That's good, Shane. That's good. There's a number of good thoughts jumping through my mind here, and I have trouble relaxing. It looks like our number of participants is kind of dwindling here. It looks like we lost Abraham. Would anybody else, Janet or Stone, David, like to jump in a little bit and share in the discussion a little bit more? I have trouble collecting my thoughts when during a lot of this, and sometimes I need a little bit of a breather to try to think about how I'm going to respond to the profound issues that Shane raised or some of the others. So I'm enjoying the heck out of it.
This is David. I did want to say thank you very much for having me in tonight. I did want to kind of end also. I'm going to have to leave here pretty soon myself, but I did want to just emphasize how I do like very much your proactive approach to letter writing and notifications, but if we can make it public postings, anything else to document a history of nonviolent attempts and truth. Those are all very important aspects leading up to if there is any drawing of the line that. There is a track record, it's public, and it hopefully will be followed up with good media attention. I yield. And I want to thank everybody for being here tonight and inviting me into this very good conversation. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you, David. Have a good night. All right, ladies and gentlemen. My lengthy agenda is more. I'm looking forward to the day when we'll have more here. Shane and Janet, are you both enthused about trying to continue to do these every Tuesday evening, or what do you think?
I think it's good for us. We've only been going at this for about 6 or 7 weeks. So the West has been going at this for over a year. So we're just new. We're very new to this. We just I guess we had hoped it would go a little bit faster, but as we can see, it's sort of step by step, stone on stone, and. The problem, I don't know if we're going to run out of time, because these people are really putting the pedal to the metal. It's like everything is falling apart. You can't go to Walmart. You can't go to a superstore. You can't go to school. You can't go to the hospital. Everything is interfered with. And at what point does the law fix that? At what point does the Constitution fix that? I'm in the middle of a, I would have to say, a communist state, because even we have an election going on right now. If you can imagine a provincial election, the gall of the politicians to run an election, supposedly we have the biggest disease that Canada's ever had, and let's have an election so that we can get a position and a financial advantage for ourselves. These are the people we're dealing with. Everywhere I look, signs for liberals, liberals. What would it take? What would it take for these people to go, I don't think they're nice people. I don't think they're doing... There's liberal signs everywhere here in New Brunswick.
Janet?
What on earth is wrong with the people of Canada? There's something wrong with us. And I don't know. I don't know if a constitution... I hate to be... I'm a very optimistic person. But I got to say, there's something wrong that we can't even figure that out. That if this is a solution, if this is our lifeline, there's like very few people going for it. If I don't know if we have a year. Like you guys in out west, you've had a year. I don't know if we're going to survive a year with all this. The people are already exhausted. I've been to like 6 rallies. I've been to anti-vaccination, anti-climate change, anti-mask, education. We're exhausted. We're exhausted. We're doing what we're supposed to. We're trying to learn and understand. But most people are just, oh, no, we're good. We're good. What is wrong with you people? Of course you should wear a mask. Huh. Oh, my God, we're living with communists everywhere, and it's like... It's frightening, actually. It's just like I don't know. It's like, anyway, thank you. I think it does help, because it's sort of like especially it's good to talk to Shane, and it is good to talk to the American people, because I'm hoping it's like some reason. These are reasonable people that we're talking to. How come we all get it, and then a lot of these people out here, they're just like, they're so oblivious. Like, how are they going to learn? It's very complex what we're going through. Building a constitution, talking about courts. I mean, it's sort of like, I don't even think these people could serve ice cream without an instruction manual. Like, it's going to, you have to have an intelligent population. I was a nurse for 40 years, so I explain this all the time. I was an emergency room nurse. When something happens, you have to react. And you have to react appropriately and quickly. There's no reaction. There's very little. It's like the patient is like almost on flatline here. Nobody is responding. Like they need to be really crazy and go, you know what? We really need to get moving here. The train is coming. It's going to hit us. And people are like, oh, no, we're good. Let's put a liberal sign on our lawn and let's have an election now in the middle of a pandemic. What is wrong with that? What is wrong with the people? Anyway, thanks for listening to my rant. I think that probably helps me keep stable. I'm not going to give up hope. You know, we're going as fast as we can. But I say we lack expertise. A lot of people in their provinces, they have wonderful leaders. They've got like Rocco Galati. They've got Max Bernier. You know, you guys have Dallas. You've got all these big, who have we got here? There's all grandmothers running our board. We can't even get a man to come and go on Zoom. Yeah. It's something else, I'm telling you.
Janet, I want to quickly interject with something that I think might.
Should I calm down now? Sorry.
Well, no. But this might help. This might help put things into perspective for you, because you're waking people up, but it's slow, right? It's not easy, and you're doing it one by one and stuff. How do you think people are going to react when Alberta just goes and they're a republic? Do you think that'll?
I love it. My brother lives in Edmonton, and I'm like, so you guys go one of us.
I mean the people in New Brunswick that are say not putting up their liberal signs and they're just in the system. Do you think it'll help wake them up when a province actually just gets up and goes?
No. I don't think they'll even notice. I gotta be terribly. I don't think they'll even notice. You know what? As long as somebody keeps sending them payments, they don't care who it is. I hate to say it. There's very few people. Like I said, you have to have a population that's A, motivated, B, like, you know, like if you gave the people a vote tomorrow and said, listen, the government will pay for everything, you'll have to give up some rights, or you could have a republic and you'll have to do some work, you know what they're going to do? Yeah, they're not going to pick the hard work, I'm telling you. I was in the election. I was helping PPC candidate. I was helping the PPC. 1.6% of Canada voted for no corruption. Every other party was corrupt. Everybody knew they were corrupt, but they didn't care. They didn't care. They're like, they saw what Scheer did. They saw what Trudeau did. They saw what the NDP did. They saw what the Green Party did. 1.6% of Canadians voted for PPC to change and to just stop, even not even things we're talking about, just to stop the, you know, the minimal corruption. 1.6 people voted. And since that election, here we're going into a provincial election, people, it's like they've got signs everywhere for the Liberals. They've learned nothing in three elections. Absolutely
so about,
zero.
About Maxime Bernier. I didn't vote for Maxime Bernier.
Yeah.
And I vetted him. He's been in government for 30 years. He's been a member of parliament. And he knows exactly the situation we're in constitutionally. It was raised to him personally.
Right. Well, since then I've learned that. Since then I have learned all of that. But he was at least we would have not been going through some of it. It would have been a more subtle velvet glove type of government. I agree. Behind the scenes, he never changed the banking. He was in finances. He never had any influence. I realize that now. None of them represent us, but at least he was, you know, he would have cut down on the immigration, like give us a breather. Give us a breather with the deficit. Give us a breather with all kinds of things. I'm not saying it would have been perfect, but what are the alternatives? Four of the parties are communists. What can I say?
Charles,
they're just out and out communists.
Charles, Maxime Bernier is our equivalent to Gary Johnson.
Yeah. Well, again, what I've learned from this process is it's not about personality. It's about we the people. Who does it matter? As long as we have our law and we have our goodness, you know, our moral and lawfulness. It doesn't matter who we are, like individually as far as personalities. This has been our problem, our downfall. Oh, look at him. He's from money. Oh, look at him. He's got an education. Look at him. He's this, he's that. Those days are what got us into this problem. It's about what is decent, what is lawful. Could we just do that? And it's apparently no. Apparently that's not appealing at all because it's too much work. And I hate to be, this is what I'm finding. I guess the muck is sticking to me. There is a lot of enthusiasm. There is a lot of young people, but they're not coming to do the work. They just come to do the protests so far. When they find out what they have to do, it's really been sort of complex. So it's up to us to try to teach as best we can. And like I say, you guys took a year. I don't know if we're going to last a year with all the things that are happening. So I as the weeks go by, my anxiety is kind of rising. I was very optimistic that this is a solution. I've been looking for a solution for about 2-3 years. I've been following what's going on in the States, and I used to think, oh, Canada's way superior. We don't have any of those problems. I found out, oh my gosh, ours are just as bad and worse. And the people themselves, at least, you know, the Americans, I find they're very patriotic. They're very patriotic, and they're very aware of what are their rights and their unalienable rights. Canadians, you tell them that they have rights as a human being, and they're like, no big. Like, they're willing to trade it off for if you send them an extra $300 a month, they wouldn't care. It's a terrible state to be in. And I don't know if that's something to say about our character, because we're very easygoing people, and or if we're just hypnotized. You know, money has become the new emperor, And even my own children, they say, well, what do we need a constitution for? What do we need it for? Oh, my gosh, that's the young people. I don't know. Anyway, I feel like a voice crying in the wilderness. I think that these are the good people, so I want to keep returning just because it does help us. It gives us fresh ideas. Like, we would never have known about natural law and common law unless it was through here. So that's a very important concept for us to, you know, learn about and discuss and develop. And, you know, it's also support to see other Canadians across Canada. And we are very close to the States. We're right on top of Maine. And actually, I travel to the States a lot. So, you know, I'm one of those Canadians that I love the States. I love the American people. But even you can't even say anything about Donald Trump here. People will lose their minds. So we have there's a lot of cultural problems, not just, you know, the things that we're talking about. There's a lot of circles that are gone off. But this is, to me, is where normal people are.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for listening.
Sure. I think maybe a lot of what we're talking about here is the spiritual growth process. And it kind of gets biblical on that there's a separating work between the people that really love liberty and justice for the common people and the people that don't. There's a lot of people that they're only concerned about their next meal and how much money they've got in their bank account, and that's all the further they think. They're not much different than reptilians. But then there's others of us that are empathetic, that feel the pain of our fellow human beings. You know, there's a lot of people in this general movement that pretend to be empathetic people. They pretend to be concerned about truth and justice and peace, but they're here to make sure that the slaves don't successfully revolt. And so, you know, we need to be nurturing when we've got the respect and the trust flowing amongst some of us, even a small group in number like what we've got here. If we've got a degree of respect and trust and everybody's talking calm, nobody's raising their voice and screaming at each other, these are all earmarkings of a righteous, high-quality community being built. If you guys are still up to continuing forward with these Tuesday evening conferences on a weekly basis, we can do that. I do have a friend that is a real close activist here in the States that says Tuesday evening is a little bit of a problem for him. I think a lot of reasons that we linked on Tuesday evening here was because Dallas was kind of picked the Tuesday evening. But I don't know how enthused Dallas is about continuing with us here. And I'd kind of like to think in terms of maybe if Wednesday evening, would that be a big difference to either of you two if we switched the conference over to Wednesday evening instead of Tuesday evening? Or would that be problematic for either of you? Any of you?
No, it's no problem for me. Just not Thursday.
Okay.
Not Thursday.
Okay, yeah, not... Yeah. How about you, Shane or Stone?
Wednesdays is perfect for me as well. That works for me. I just came in basically evenings, like this time of evening is perfect for me.
Okay.
But I'm also with Janet. Thursday is my only day out because I do my Newfoundland Zoom meeting on Thursday evening.
Yeah, Thursday's a popular night, and I'll avoid that. That will make my other associate here, Michael Zarzano from Florida, he did want to join with us, but he has a commitment here Tuesday evenings. So I think in the spirit that I do think we're accomplishing good work here, even though we're quite a small group, I think we should carry on with it. Do we have agreement? Do we have consensus on that point? We should try to carry on with this?
Absolutely.
I think
very
so.
Good. Okay, very good. I'll hang. Yes, I'll continue energizing this then, but I will reschedule for 8 days away from tonight on Wednesday evening of next week, if that sounds good for you guys. At that point, should we think about concluding comments or just directly put a wrap on it? There's only four of us here. What do y'all think?
I have Shane? One thing. Now that we're Canadians only besides yourself, because I didn't want to annoy anybody from the States with this, I'm going to read that Section 12 for you, Charles.
Oh, boy. Sounds good.
Keeping in mind that this is all one sentence, there are no periods, everything, and you'll understand the significance, everything in this is separated by commas only.
Yeah, lawyers do that. They're weasels. They do that kind of stuff. Go ahead, Jim.
So this is the executive power. So all powers under acts to be exercised by Governor General with advice of Privy Council or alone. That's the header. Now the sentence starts. All powers, authorities, and functions which under any act of the Parliament of Great Britain or of the Parliament of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland or of the Legislature of Upper Canada, Lower Canada, Canada, Nova Scotia, or New Brunswick are at the Union vested in or exercisable by the respective governors or lieutenant governors of those provinces with the advice or with the advice and consent, or the respective executive councils thereof, or in conjunction with those councils, or with any number of members thereof, or by those governor generals or lieutenants individually, shall, as far as the same, continue in existence and capable of being exercised under the Union in relation to the Government of Canada, be vested in and exercisable by the Governor General with the advice or with the advice and consent of or in conjunction with the Queen's Privy Council of Canada or any members thereof or by the Governor General individually, as the case requires, subject nevertheless, except with respect to such as exist under Acts of Parliament of Great Britain or of the Parliament of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, to be abolished or altered by the Parliament of Canada. Full stop.
Yeah, that is a pretty long sentence. I'm not sure it's the biggest one in existence, but it's definitely stretching it.
Got to be pushing it.
Yeah. And the lawyer doublespeak in there is just screaming at you, isn't it? Yeah. That's quite a performance there. When was that written,
Shane?
1862.
1867.
Oh.
No. 1867.
Ah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, that was. It was written in 1867, and then existed until 1982, and then it was repatriated with our Constitution Act, which brought us our Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Right.
And then the whole Constitution Act became one document. An act of parliament.
All right. Well, should we put a wrap on this? What do you guys think?
Yes, I have to go. I want to say thank you so much, Charles and Shane. Always a pleasure. Mr. Stone, thank you.
See
you next time.
I think I'm going to hang on for a little bit here. If Janet or Shane or anybody wants to drop off, okay. But I see my friend Mike from Florida just joined us, and I think I will chat with him for a little bit. If you guys want to hang around, that's great. But if you want to leave, that whatever you need to do there, Janet or Shane, Michael.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Janet. Take care, Shane. Michael, how you doing?
Hey, Charles. Real good. Just got home and was glad to hear you guys still on. That's great. You've been on 2 hours now, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And it looks like Kamala just joined with us, too. Hi, Kamala.
Yes, Kamala. Greetings.
Hi. Good to see you. Yeah, we finished up a lot with our Canadian activists to the north here, and we agreed to shift around the scheduling of next week's weekday conference to Wednesday evenings at the request of Michael there in Florida. Michael indicated that it'll help him a whole lot in his scheduling if we can move everything to Florida, and I got agreement from Janet and Shane here that would be good with most of their Canadian group also. I hope you can join with us too on Wednesday evening there, Kamala.
Oh, I might be able to. I'll have to work something
okay.
out.
Okay, okay. Well, it's always good to have you. And we did cover a few good points there. I guess the recording will be available for you both if you want to listen to it later. But as long as we're in conference here, you guys just showed up. I'm certainly willing to share some conversation if you feel like chatting for a little bit.
Well, sure, if I may. Could you just give a brief summary of the highlights of tonight's call?
Sure. The majority here was from Canada. In fact, I think we've got a fellow here, Stone, that is still with us. He said something a little bit earlier. Stone, I believe you're also from Canada, aren't you? Could you affirm or... I haven't heard much from him, but anyway, we did talk about issues such as the Canadians feel that we in the States here have more rights and less tyranny and despotism because our Constitution documents specifically affirm such things as the rules of the common law, and we have bills of rights that grant specific recognition to our rights and things, and they don't have documents like that. But I think I made a good point in pointing out that when the USA declared independence from England, that rather put a brick wall between us and the common law tradition in its pure form, and whereas they don't have that brick wall to deal with because they never declared independence from the English realm. And I tapped into Magna Carta there too. And in last Tuesday's call with some of the other leaders, there was critique of Magna Carta, like it was a subversive document. And I know it did have problems, but it also had profound protections that I think are important for us to try to capitalize on. And I think I also drew that point out, that Magna Carta has many, many very powerful provisions in it. And if we can just point out where the government of Canada, as well as the government of the USA and the government of England, are all in violation of those fundamental provisions of Magna Carta, that's a legitimate talking point that we can emphasize and we can get in the faces of the de factos about, that is obligatory over them. They all admit that Magna Carta is obligatory over them. And so we can make a stink about that. It's not the negative document that a lot of people like to presume. Hi, Adam. Good to see you. So that's kind of a summary there, Michael. I'd yield there, Michael or anybody.
So if I may, since no one else is taking the floor, I thought I'd ask a question. Was there any discussion as to how Canada and the Patriots up there are organizing and growing their movement in their local communities? Is there any discussion on that?
Shane did get into emphasizing the individual constitutional conventions of each of the individual provinces, similar to our states, that they're calling, in essence, constitutional convention for their states / provinces. I think that's about probably what we did talk about that for a little bit, and I think that might be the main focal point that would be a positive yes response to your question, Michael.
Okay, it sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah. Our community group was rather small. I think we probably peaked at about a dozen people or so there. At one point, David Scheib was with us and a couple of others from Canada and a couple of others from the States. Then it was dwindling down quite a bit up until the three of you, Autumn and Kamala and Mike, just showed up here all about at the same time. After the two-hour mark, you must have just got done with busy duties. And we can chatter some more if you like. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I see that there's a conflict on the call. There's the education call for the Republic is tonight. It looks like at the exact same time, 9 p.m. Eastern on September 8th, which is tonight, Tuesday night. So that may be a conflict, and why some of the people didn't make it over onto this call, because actually I don't know if Lewis is on this call or if he may be on the other one, but Cliff did tell me about it. So I may have to jump off and jump back on. I may have to go over and check on that one and then come back on. So I just wanted to let you know, if I drop off, I'll probably be coming back on.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure how much longer we'll go here, Kamala, but certainly if we're still here, you're more than welcome to come back with us here.
All right. Thank you. And greetings and salutations to all the family over in Canada.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. We're even though you guys are now here, which is nice. I've had a pretty good little run here in talking about a number of good issues, and I can rise to the occasion again if there's anything on the mind of you, Mike, or Autumn here. I can respond pretty good, but I'm not up to providing live entertainment here. either of you?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty tired, and we had a very involved evening. And I just wanted to get a short summary of what happened, and I'm encouraged and look forward to next Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll be doing it then. You wouldn't care to do a quick summary on the meeting that you had there in the center?
I will. We had, probably 60 to 70 people, and it was kind of a, just a Patriot meeting, Tea Party meeting. We had initially, when we started out, we had different people around the room give updates and news briefs, and I talked about the new quarter. Are you aware of the new quarter that has the bat on the back of it, the U.S. quarter?
I think I saw a coin with a bat on it. I didn't know it was a new USA quarter.
Yeah, it's the new quarter in the United States. It has a bat on the back of it, 2020 quarter. Blood-sucking bat of 2020.
Yeah, well, that's a nice Christian symbol, isn't it?
Oh, it's evil, yeah.
Sarcasm, I shouldn't do something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. we talked about that, and we just went around the room with different news briefs, and there's going to be a big prayer, 3-day prayer meeting in the same building. We talked about that briefly, and one of the speakers tonight, the organizer, Randy, he talked about a list of miracles that happened during the Revolutionary War prior to and even up to the War of 1812, different events that were very miraculous having to do with weather and fog, hiding soldiers and encampments and at the most opportune opportune time, ships being blown away from the shore that were planning on attacking. Just some very interesting tales, stories. It was just a good time of fellowship where the saints of God and the patriots can come together and have camaraderie and fellowship, and iron sharpens iron, you know. So that was about it.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good report. Thank you, Michael.
Yep. And I will go for now, and we'll talk again soon, Charles, okay?
Okay. Yeah. Take care, Michael.
Uh-huh. Good night.
Good night. Autumn, you care to chit-chat a little bit?
Hi, Charles. Autumn, can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you doing?
Good. Because I actually, to tell you, that I had guests unexpected, and they left, and then I'm calling. I'm on my Republic call on my home line, and I'm on this call right now. But I'm sorry I missed it. I appreciate everything, and I hopefully can figure out how to get in, because I'm not real techie. And I don't know how to get in on this share stuff, like screen stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it can be a bit complicated. It can be a bit complicated.
No, I appreciate this, okay? I truly do.
All right.
There's a lot of us that are very active, and on, you know, I'm on 3 different conference calls, including yours, okay?
All right.
So, through the week. So, you know, we can... Wherever we can get some help, education, some advice, that's what I'm looking for right now. You know, we really have a lot on us, as even trying to find, you know, people that are willing to come join us and kind of take some of this workload off of us. But that's a, you know, issue within itself. And the atmosphere, you know, of people's fear and masks and things, people that's not awake. So, you know, we really have a lot of work, and I just very much appreciate everyone like yourself and my other conference people that set this up for us.
Excellent.
Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, the calls are kind of back-to-back, or they're happening at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you say you've got another call going in the background?
I do. It's on my landline, but I got it down. Because we actually were supposed to have a guest speaker tonight, but they're not in. And we got some documents, and it's very, you know, it's a lot of good information coming from everywhere, kind of the same, but sometimes different, okay? And sometimes things you hear on one call that I could bring to this call, but not tonight at this moment, because I'm on 2 phones,
two different
calls. At the same time.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll talk to you in private, maybe, okay? Because I think I'm going to hang up right now from this call so I can put my attention to my Republic call.
That sounds like a perfect plan here, sister.
Thank you, and God bless you. Have a good night.
You too. Good night now, Autumn.